It is gone! A two-run home run for Rhys Hoskins into the second deck for Bryce Harper. Swing and a miss. He got him! And Aaron Nola leads two. Segura on the run. Reaches up and makes the grab!
Swing and a miss! Struck him out!
Now batting for the Phillies, John Stolness.
Hey there, podcast pals, and welcome back to another edition of Hittin' Season. This is episode number 428. I'm John Stolness from The Good Fight. You can follow me on Twitter at John Stolness. Coming up, I'm going to have more fallout from the Fall Classic. We'll talk about the Justin Turner COVID-19 incident, Major League Baseball's response, Kevin Cash removing his starting pitcher way too early, and we'll get into some feel-good stuff too, specifically for Clayton Kershaw, who finally got that World Series ring. The Phillies free agency has officially kicked off. The offseason is officially underway. We're going to talk about all that stuff coming up with Phillies beat writer Megan Montemuro from The Athletic, and the Phillies are going to need another coach. We have another coaching vacancy that has popped up with the Phillies here in the last couple days to tell you about. Plus, I will have your stat of the week. But before we get into all that, just a reminder to check out our Hittin' Season Patreon. Some bonus content up there for you to make sure you don't miss. It's at patreon.com/hittin'season. Just as important, if not more important, folks, make sure, please, if you haven't done so yet, leave a 5-star rating at the Good Fight podcast feed on Apple Podcasts and tell a friend about this podcast. We're going to be talking about the Phillies and Major League Baseball stuff all off season, and it's going to be a very interesting one. So make sure that if you have a Phillies fan, they like podcasts, but they haven't discovered the Good Fight podcast feed, Hittin' Season, Continued Success, The Dirty Inning, all the other stuff we do, make sure to let them know and have them leave a 5-star rating at Apple Podcasts. But you can find us on Stitcher, Spotify, wherever it is you get your podcasts, right? All right, let's jump into the Fall Classic here. And of course, as you all know by now, the Dodgers 1-6 games. They finally scaled that mountain. They finally won that elusive world title that was really, in a way, stolen from them by the cheating 2017 Astros, and then lost to the Red Sox a couple years ago, lost to the Nationals last year. Really was a long road for the Los Angeles Dodgers. They'd won 8 straight National League West titles, won 2 pennants, lost in the World Series 2 straight years, but this year, they dominated in the postseason. They ran roughshod all over the Milwaukee Brewers in the NL Wild Card Series. They beat the division rival Padres in the NL Division Series. And then they were one loss away from going home early yet again when they went into a 3-1 series hole against the Atlanta Braves in the NLCS, but won 3 straight to get back to the Fall Classic. Played a classic Game 4 against the Rays in which it looked like Tampa had stolen momentum from them after the Dodgers kicked the ball away in the bottom of the ninth and allowed the Rays to steal Game 4. But they came back strong, winning the last 2 games of the series and win their first World Series title since 1988. From 1989 through 2020, 637 players appeared in at least one regular season game for the Los Angeles Dodgers. And before we get to the negative stuff, one of the guys I wanted to talk about that you just have to feel great for is Clayton Kershaw. Clayton Kershaw has done it all in his major league career, and some of his numbers are going to be from my stat of the week, but he played in 19 postseason rounds before the 2020 World Series. That's the most played before appearing in a World Series that ultimately led to a title. This is from Sarah Langs of MLB.com. Nobody had ever played more rounds before finally winning it all. Now, of course, this comes as we've added additional rounds to the playoffs, but still, 19 postseason rounds before winning it all is a Major League Baseball record and something that I can't imagine. Well, maybe it'll be beat once, you know, at some point. It is worth noting that one player did play more rounds and never won it all. Former Philly Kenny Lofton, who played 20 postseason rounds and never won a title. And if we go back to Kershaw's first ever postseason appearance, it came against your Philadelphia Phillies back in the Phil's championship season of 2008. He made his first postseason appearance in relief in Game 2 of the National League Championship Series. He faced 6 batters in the 7th and 8th innings. Pedro Feliz, Jimmy Rollins, Shane Victorino, Chase Utley, Ryan Howard, and Eric Bruntlett. And he also made another relief appearance in Game 4 of that series, facing Howard, Pat Burrell, and Victorino. By the way, that's the Matt Stairs game, everybody, when Shane Victorino and Matt Stairs hit two-run home runs in the top of the eighth inning to give the Phillies that 7-5 lead. His first postseason start came in 2009 in Game 2 of the NL Division Series against the Cardinals. He allowed two runs in 6 2/3 innings in a Dodgers win. He had a 13-strikeout game in Game 2 of the Wild Card Series this year, where he threw 8 scoreless innings, and he also notched 11 strikeouts with no walks in his World Series debut in Game 1 in 2017. So I know the narrative around Clayton Kershaw is that he couldn't win the big one. He was a poor October performer, and there's no doubt about the fact that Clayton Kershaw's October numbers pale in comparison to his regular season numbers. But this postseason, Clayton Kershaw came to play, and he walked home with his first World Series title after 19 postseason rounds of going without. By the way, Dodgers closer Kenley Jansen had gone 16 postseason rounds before finally winning it all. So you got to feel good for a couple of these Dodgers players who had been suffering for a long time waiting to win that first ever World Series title. But now we got to talk about some of the unfortunate stuff. And that, you know, one of these things is unfortunate, and just one of these is controversial. Let's talk about Justin Turner. And I will be honest with you that some of this still does not make a whole lot of sense. But at some point on the day of Game 6, at some point on Tuesday, a COVID-19 test for Dodgers third baseman Justin Turner came back inconclusive. Now, according to Major League Baseball protocols, an inconclusive test should be treated the same as a positive test for erring on the side of caution. However, Justin Turner was in the starting lineup and played in Game 6. At some point during the course of that game, a second test that was performed on Justin Turner came back positive, and Turner was pulled in the eighth inning of that game. However, after being pulled from the eighth inning of that game, after the Dodgers won and they were celebrating on the field, Justin Turner went back out onto the field, defying Major League Baseball protocol, and in fact, defying Major League Baseball security, who informed him that he should not go back on the field. And Turner chose to ignore that and went back on the field to celebrate with his teammates, and had turned the Dodgers celebration into a potential super spreader event. And it unfortunately casts a dark cloud, a negative shadow over the celebration, over the World Series championship win, because people are talking about Justin Turner and celebrating on the field. And, you know, you hope that future tests come back negative and that it was a false positive, and that, you know, maybe at that point, if that were to happen, you can look back at the Dodger celebration and not feel as bad about it. But somewhere along the line here, something went horribly wrong. And Major League Baseball issued a statement in which they blame the player and absolve themselves, really, of any responsibility for allowing Justin Turner to even take the field in the first place with an inconclusive test hanging in the wind. All right, so here's the statement. In response to inquiries, Major League Baseball issued the following statement. Immediately upon receiving notice from the laboratory of a positive test, protocols were triggered, leading to the removal of Justin Turner from last night's game. Turner was placed into isolation for the safety of those around him. However, following the Dodgers' victory, it is clear that Turner chose to disregard the agreed-upon joint protocols and the instructions he was given regarding the safety and protection of others. While a desire to celebrate is understandable, Turner's decision to leave isolation and enter the field was wrong and put everyone he came into contact with at risk. When MLB security raised the matter of being on the field with Turner, he emphatically refused to comply. The commissioner's office is beginning a full investigation into this matter and will consult with the Players Association within the parameters of the joint 2020 operations manual. Last night, nasal swabs were conducted on the Dodgers traveling party. Both the Rays and Dodgers were tested again today, and their travel back to their home cities will be determined after being approved by the appropriate authorities. So, some things in this statement to take note of. One, they do not address their own culpability in allowing Turner to play when a previous test came back inconclusive. Again, protocol states he's not allowed to play. He should not have been out on the field in that game. Major League Baseball, the Dodgers, someone screwed that up. Somewhere along the line, something got messed up there. Then to put all of the onus on Justin Turner. Listen, Justin Turner deserves as much blame for this, deserves as much criticism for his actions as you can heap upon him. And unfortunately, he has sullied the Dodgers celebration. He has sullied the World Championship, because this is what we're talking about. The conversation should be about Clayton Kershaw and Kenley Jansen and the Dodgers overcoming all of their obstacles during a pandemic-shortened season to win the World Series after years, year after year after year after year of coming short and finally breaking that long curse of not having won since 1988. And now we're talking about this. The only way you can look at this in a way that makes sense is, and I guess this might be what the Dodgers were thinking, is that he'd already exposed himself to his teammates by that point. So allowing him back on the field did not really put his teammates in any greater risk or put anybody else on the field at any greater risk, because he'd already exposed. Basically, the cat was already out of the bag. Well, that's not necessarily true. And if you saw on the field him kissing his wife on the field, celebrating after a positive COVID-19 test, that should strike everyone as absolutely crazy that was allowed to happen. His decision to leave isolation and enter the field was wrong, and he put everyone he came into contact with at risk. When MLB security raised the matter of being on the field with Turner, he emphatically refused to comply. I would love to know what that looked like. I'd love to know what does MLB security look like? I don't know. I don't know if this is a burly secure. I'm envisioning a burly security guard in a red blazer going with a walkie-talkie, talking to Justin Turner, saying, you can't go back on the field. And Justin Turner emphatically refusing to comply. My read of that is getting in the MLB security guy's face and saying, you're going to have to take me down if you don't want me to get on the field. And you know what the MLB security guy should have done? He probably should have taken him down. I don't know, but I don't know how this all played out. The way that this statement reads is that MLB security raised the matter of being on the field with Turner. Are these guys not allowed to physically restrict players from violating MLB protocol? They might not be. I'm not necessarily blaming MLB security. I'm just wondering what their role is here. They're there to just advise, raise the matter. They're not actually there to try and protect people. They're not there to try and enforce protocol. So we're leaving the security and the protection of other people on some Major League Baseball player who selfishly wants to go out and celebrate with his teammates. And look, I get it. Justin Turner's been on the Dodgers for a long time. He has been working hard to finally win this World Series. He wanted to be there with his teammates. I understand that. But at another point, you have to be a grown-up as well. And this was a selfish, petulant, childish act. And it sounds like he threw a hissy fit in order to get back on the field. That's not right. And he's taking all of the criticism that he should, and it should be relentless. Major League Baseball Commissioner Rob Manfred should be criticized relentlessly for this. I mean, given how this Major League Baseball season started, given all the inane stuff Rob Manfred said and did in the lead up to this season getting started, given how things started off this season with the Marlins COVID outbreak and all the different COVID tests that came up, the fact that they got this season done, the fact that they, until this latest incident, had a postseason that was COVID-free was a miracle. But this season also was a PR disaster. I mean, I think a lot of us have kind of forgotten all of the salary issues that went into place. And we're going to have another offseason where salary and payroll and all, and you know, the union screaming about owners not paying players and wanting to see the owners' books in order to compare the losses they suffered this year to gains they'd seen in previous seasons. That's all going to be coming back here, guys. We're not going to just have a fun season of talking about potential trades and free agent signings and all that. The business of baseball is going to take center stage this offseason once again, because you're going to see Major League Baseball teams not pay players. And there's no doubt they took a financial hit this year. But this is all going to come back, and it's going to remind us all of the start of the season and trying to get this thing underway. And this was just a fitting end to that. And this comes from somebody who loves baseball. I love this game. But this is unbelievable that this was allowed to happen. And the fact that this happened in Game 6 of the 2020 World Series, that a player had to be pulled in the 8th inning because he was allowed to play with an inconclusive test, just tells you Major League Baseball got this wrong in so many different ways throughout the course of the season. And here's the other unfortunate thing to come out of Game 6 of the 2020 World Series. It was Kevin Cash's decision to remove Blake Snell, because now you have an argument again of analytics versus non-analytics. And I have certainly understood that, especially over the last couple of years after watching Gabe Kapler in action, that you cannot live by a spreadsheet. Baseball cannot be managed, it cannot be general managed strictly by a spreadsheet, because you have human beings playing a game and you have to be able to use your eyes and make decisions that way. You still need scouts. You still need experienced managers. You still need people who know what they're doing. There's got to be some kind of a balance. This is the balance the Phillies have had trouble finding over the last few years. It's one of the reasons that John Middleton brought in Joe Girardi, because he felt that Joe Girardi is good with analytics, but he also uses his gut and uses his eyes, and sometimes that's good, sometimes that'll backfire. You can say the same thing for using analytics. Analytics itself are not bad. And if your takeaway from Blake Snell removing, Kevin Cash removing Blake Snell from the game after 5 1/3 shutout innings in which he'd only given up 2 hits and struck out 9, if your reaction to that is to say analytics are horrible, that's the wrong reaction. Because analytics are what got the Rays and the Dodgers to the World Series. It's why they're great year in and year out, and especially in the Rays' case when they don't spend any money whatsoever. They win trade after trade. They develop great player after great player. Analytics is largely responsible for all that. They have figured out how to use analytics to improve player development, to make great trades, and to make smart free agent signings. If you were to give some of these Rays executives and front office people actual money to work with, imagine what they could do. So this is not they could do what the Dodgers do, which is use their financial heft and analytics to create a dynasty that is 8 years running. This is what we want. This is what we want the Phillies to be. We want the Phillies to know how to use the analytics. Analytics in baseball are not a bad thing. You want more information. You want as much information as you can get your hands on. It's knowing how to use that information properly, and it's not becoming a slave to that information. And Kevin Cash, in Game 6, became a slave to his information. He became a slave to the analytics that say you never let a pitcher pitch the third time through the order. And it's something, I will grant you, he had done all season long with Blake Snell. He'd done it all season long, and when you've got a bullpen as good as Tampa's, you can get away with it. But in this case, he had to leave Blake Snell in this baseball game. Kevin Kiermaier, their star center fielder, criticized his own manager. He said, "I don't care what the numbers say, that was Blake's game. That might have been the best I've seen him. That was incredible." It was. Blake Snell, when the Dodgers saw Blake Snell come out of the game, they had to be doing cartwheels. Because Blake Snell was killing him. And I don't care. We have seen pitchers who, a third time through the order, a fourth time through the order, are still effective. We saw Gabe Kapler make the same mistake with Aaron Nola in his first ever game managing the Phillies in the season opener against the Atlanta Braves to start the 2018 season. It was exactly the same. And this move has worked for Kevin Cash in the past, but it doesn't mean it was right. In this case, he was absolutely wrong. He was absolutely, and you know, hey, listen, it was a one-run game. It was 1-0 at the time in the sixth inning. And he knows, you know, a guy comes up, hits a home run with a runner on base. It's a 2-1 game. So I understand the argument. I do understand the thought process. But you have to use your eyes and look at what the pitcher's doing and know how it's going to affect the team, too. You can't expect the players, when Tampa players see the manager coming out, pulling a pitcher who is just mowing people down, that can't be something that gives you confidence. And so I think this is an issue in Major League Baseball where you have some teams, you have some front offices, you have some people, some managers who are slaves to the data. And you can't be slaves to the data, but you have to use it. We can't throw the baby out with the bathwater, guys. This information is out there. I don't like every player trying to launch the ball out for home runs. I don't like that that's what this game has become. I will also tell you, that the team that hit the most home runs went 35-3 this postseason. The team that hit the most home runs in each of these postseason games went 35-5. So hitting home runs does help you win baseball games. But I was watching some highlights of 2008. It's just amazing to see how many more guys put the ball in play in 2008. It makes the game more enjoyable. This is definitely, I mean, their analytics, the way hitters approach hitting nowadays, it certainly might be more efficient, but it doesn't make it a better game. And I don't know where we go from here as a sport, because there are people who are casual fans of baseball who just hate this. They hate what the sport has become, and I can't blame them. I love baseball. I'll always love baseball. I don't care what it becomes. But I can understand if you don't love baseball, you couldn't have liked what you've seen. And you know what? There are people who love baseball who hate what the game has become. And I don't necessarily listen to all the old players, because old players always think the game was best when they were playing. That's going to be the case generation by generation by generation. But there is something going on in Major League Baseball that is not great. And it's people who are slaves to the analytics. But I do want you to hear me. And you're going to hear this on talk radio. You're going to hear this in other places, about people screaming about analytics in baseball. Analytics in baseball are good, because all analytics are is information. It's knowing how to use that information and when to put that information aside once in a while and say, I'm going to ride my horse for another batter or two. I'm going to ride Blake Snell until he gets in a little more trouble. Maybe if the next guy comes up and knocks a single to center and you've got runners on first and second, I can understand then you come out, maybe. I could defend, but I just couldn't defend what Kevin Cash did last night, just like I couldn't defend what Gabe Kapler did in the season opener in 2018 against the Atlanta Braves. It made absolutely no sense, and it has unfortunately spawned, which I think is a wrong-headed argument that analytics in baseball is wrong. Analytics in baseball is not wrong. It's not necessarily bad for the game. Some of it is, but don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, because information is good. It just has to be used in the right way, and we've got to figure out a way to use information in a way that doesn't make the game aesthetically worse. Efficiency does not always equate with entertainment, and I think that's baseball's big problem right now, weighing efficiency with entertainment. Right now, efficiency is winning, and that's fine, but the entertainment product is suffering, and people don't like what they see right now, and it was thrown in everybody's face like a cold bucket of water when Kevin Cash pulled Blake Snell from the game on Tuesday night, Game 6, a move that would ultimately cost the Tampa Bay Rays a chance of moving on and playing a Game 7.
This ball is out of here!
All right, before we get to our interview with Megan Montemuro, a couple of quick Phillies notes. With the end of the World Series, free agency has officially begun, or at least a number of Phillies players became free agents, 7 Phillies free agents, in fact. We all know JT Realmuto, Didi Gregorius, also Jake Arrieta, Jose Alvarez, Jay Bruce, Tommy Hunter, and Brandon Workman. If the Phillies decline the option on David Phelps's contract, Phelps will become a free agent as well. Teams have until Sunday to file a qualifying offer. I'm sorry. Teams have 5 more days to negotiate exclusively with these free agents before the market opens. Qualifying offers, which are just under $19 million, $18.9 million, are due by Sunday. Now, Jim Salisbury of NBC Sports Philadelphia, who was our guest on last week's episode of the podcast, said, according to a person close to Realmuto, the catcher, an Oklahoma native, would like to remain in Philadelphia and is not particularly keen on playing in New York. However, as Salisbury notes, and these are his words, if that's where the record-setting money is, Realmuto will eat heroes instead of hoagies. Now, Scott Lauber of the Philadelphia Inquirer, a good friend of the podcast, noted that he thinks the Phillies have, or he estimated that the club has about $35 to $41 million to spend in the free agent market this winter. So they could afford JT Realmuto. Again, that's And again, we don't know exactly how much they're going to spend in the free agent market, but it sounds like someone in the front office is telling him the Phillies do have some money to spend. But MLB.com's Mark Feinson noted that the Yankees could move on from Gary Sanchez and become major players. And the Mets have declined the option, the $10 million option on Wilson Ramos's contract. And so they are desperate for a new catcher. And they have presumptive new owner Steve Cohen waiting in the wings. Now, there is a little bit of a hiccup with Steve Cohen taking over as the new York Mets owner. He's going to sail through with a, I think it's probably going to be a unanimous vote by MLB owners to allow him to take over. But New York Mayor Bill de Blasio is throwing a monkey wrench into things because he's objecting to it, and he's allowed to do this. The New York Post is reporting that New York Mayor Bill de Blasio has privately told Major League Baseball that he will do everything he can to stop Steve Cohen from buying the Mets. The Post has learned that de Blasio called MLB Commissioner Rob Manfred earlier this month and told him outright that he opposed the idea of a hedge fund billionaire buying a local team and would be using his oversight power of the city's control of the Citi Field lease to prevent the sale from being finalized. The mayor said he's trying to invoke a clause in the stadium lease that disallows city-controlled property to be used by a prohibited person, which includes not just an individual who was convicted of a felony, but anyone who controls any person or entity that has been convicted of a felony. Cohen's hedge fund pleaded guilty to insider trading back in 2013. But it sounds as though this will probably, you know, on Friday, Major League Baseball owners are going to go ahead with a vote and he's going to be approved. But it's still a long shot that de Blasio is going to get his way. It seems for all the world like Cohen will become the next owner of the Mets. And when that happens, they're going to have an ultra billionaire taking over as owner of the team. And you can bet they're going to push hard for JT Realmuto. Also, Mark Feinson lists the Cardinals as a potential suitor because it's likely Yadier Molina will not be back, and the Angels and Nationals as other clubs to keep an eye on. That list could also continue to grow. So it looks like the Phillies could be in for a bidding war if they want to keep JT Realmuto in red and white Phillies pinstripes. And so we're going to talk about that coming up here in just a second with Megan Montemuro, and we'll get into the Fall Classic stuff with her as well. That is coming up next here on Hittin' Season. And joining me to talk a little bit more about the Fall Classic and the Phillies offseason, which has officially begun, is Megan Montemuro, the fantastic Phillies beat reporter for The Athletic. You, of course, already follow her on Twitter at @M_Montemuro. Megan, welcome back to Hittin' Season. How you doing?
I'm not too bad. Now that the World Series is over, you know, it kind of feels like the offseason is finally about to start.
Yeah, I know for Phillies fans, we've been watching the playoffs a little bit with a little bit of a bittersweet feeling, I think, because the Phillies really have had a team that should have been in that tournament. Even if they just played two games and then were done, there is really the fact that they didn't get to play in this expanded tournament this year is really something else. I wanted to ask you, before we talk about the Fall Classic, do you think they keep this format next year, or do you think we have expanded playoffs, but maybe not quite this expanded?
Unfortunately, I think that definitely could be a possibility. For me, I mean, I think it's kind of ridiculous when you have more than half the teams make the postseason.
Yeah.
You know, I think that the two wild card spots is good enough for me. You know, if you want to expand those to like a three game series, I think that would be an interesting way where, you know, you're not eliminated one game in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So for me, I'm not as big of a fan, as, you know, because I think it incentivizes teams to not really go for it. I mean, you saw teams like the Astros, you know, 500 caliber teams or worse, you know, in contention in the final days of the season. So for me, I think that kind of incentivizes too many teams to not really try to build a true winning team.
What did you think of this Fall Classic? Obviously, there was one great game. Game 4 is going to be one of the all-time greats. We'll remember it forever. As far as the entire six-game series with the Dodgers beating the Rays, what did you? You know, not an exact ranking on where this World Series is historically, but is this a memorable World Series for you? Is it memorable just because it came in a pandemic season? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think both. I think, you know, I was certainly skeptical going into that second spring training in July that they would even get to this point, especially with how things kind of started in summer camp on the Phillies end, and then obviously that the first couple days in the season with the Marlins outbreak. So, you know, the fact they even got to this point is impressive in my mind. And, you know, outside of the pandemic related things, I think when you have a team like the Dodgers who hadn't won it since 88 and trying to get back there on top, I think it was compelling. And it was an interesting kind of contrast between, you know, the big market team spending a lot of money going out and, you know, trading for Mookie Betts. And then, you know, the Rays, who have always been an interesting team, kind of having to take a different approach with, you know, payroll restrictions and whatnot. So I think from that perspective, it's interesting. I was really hoping it was going to go to a game seven. And then, you know, obviously the news breaking, like, right after the game that Justin Turner got pulled because of positive COVID tests certainly adds another layer to making that a memorable series and final game.
I wanted to first jump on Kevin Cash's decision to pull Blake Snell after, I think it was, what was it, 5 1/3 innings. He'd been through the lineup twice. He'd given up just three balls had left the infield, 9 strikeouts when he was pulled. And yes, the Rays were holding a 1-0 lead. And yes, the analytics say that pitchers struggle when they have to face a lineup the third time through. But my goodness, taking him out at that spot. I realize that the Rays use analytics. And, you know, right now the argument they have, because that blew up in the Rays' faces, analytics stink. And there's obviously some kind of gray area here where it seems like there are teams that and people who just want to throw analytics out, and teams like the Rays who don't deviate from them. And I wanted to get your thoughts on Cash's decision to pull Blake Snell in that spot.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, like you mentioned, it puts a knock on the whole analytics stuff, but I think my biggest issue was, you know, it was a single to center field. I mean, he'd been pitching well. I understand having a guy ready if another guy reaches, okay. But, I mean, this guy is supposed to be, you know, your number one starter or 1A, 1B, depending on how you view Charlie Morton. But, you know, this is a guy that you should show a little more trust in. I mean, I tweeted last night, but I'm glad that, you know, Blake Snell showed some emotion and was ticked off at the move, because so many times you hear, like, you know, how these pitchers have to buy into this strategy. But, you know, on the flip side, you also need to, you know, pay attention to what's happening in the game. And, you know, if a guy is dealing like Snell was last night, and, you know, maybe I think you got to give him a little bit more rope. And I think it was compounded by the fact that Nick Anderson, I don't think, was the right guy to go to in that situation because he hadn't been pitching well. You know, he even said after the game that, you know, I think he was a bit fatigued from youth and hadn't been very effective in the postseason. So I think that compounded it, that, you know, it blew up very quickly. And so, I mean, watching it, I was definitely reminded of, you know, Kapler's first year, especially in Philly, and that it was only the numbers, and it didn't seem like what was actually happening on the field of play was factoring into those decisions. And so it felt like a little bit of deja vu watching that because, yeah, I mean, I think, I don't know if I saw somebody tweeted it, but, you know, if the other team, if you're making the move the other team wants you to make, then it might not be the greatest move.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, so, I mean, and we've seen the Dodgers get hammered for leaving a guy like Clayton Kershaw in too long. I mean, there are instances where you can leave a pitcher in for one batter too many or two batters too many, but I don't think the Rays had reached that point last night. And I guess that's where a lot of baseball fans and a lot of baseball analysts are trying to find that sweet spot. And that's where I think baseball is struggling right now, because the Dodgers and the Rays have been two of the most successful teams over the last 3 years. They were both in the World Series, both had a chance to win it, both are model organizations, and both rely heavily on analytics. I mean, they may be the two most analytically driven teams in baseball. I mean, obviously, this works, but trying to find a balance between a strict adherence to the numbers and just going with your gut all the time and not using the numbers to your advantage, I think, especially for a team like the Phillies, it seems like the Phillies especially are a team trying to find that balance, that sweet spot. And as fans and other managers, I think, are still trying to find that sweet spot, even though we've been doing these analytics things for years now.
Right, and I think one thing that is tricky with analytics, and it doesn't seem like has been really been something that has been harnessed well or maybe it has, and that differentiates the better teams from you know, the ones that are trying to get on those levels. But is factoring in and accounting for, like, humans, you know what I mean? Like, these are not computers, and emotions matter. And it kind of comes back to the idea of, like, is a player clutch? Mm-hmm. And, you know, supposedly, not, you know, the analytics side will generally argue that that's not necessarily a real thing. But there are, for some guys, you know, you get emotional lifts from certain situations.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, and I think that's something that's very hard to quantify analytically. Kind of like the same thing with somebody's, like, you know, mental makeup or work ethic. Like, it's very hard to quantify that. And so I think it's always going to be a constant battle between, you know, factually what the numbers say versus what is actually happening and what your eyes are telling you in that moment.
Right, and if Cash had made the right pitching move in that spot and maybe brought in somebody other than Anderson, they get out of the inning and they win 1-0, no one's talking about the blow-up, and no one's saying it's a bad decision, even though it still would get talked about, like the Charlie Morton decision back in Game 7 of the ALCS. That one worked out, because when you've got a great bullpen, sometimes you get bailed out, but he defended the process there, and I just thought the process last night was totally wrong. The other process that was totally wrong last night was the COVID process by Major League Baseball and the Los Angeles Dodgers. You mentioned it a minute ago, Justin Turner's inconclusive test at the start of the game, which later came back positive in the eighth inning, caused him to be pulled. And Major League Baseball released a statement on Wednesday afternoon where they essentially were, you know, blaming Turner for going back out onto the field after the positive test had come down. But Major League Baseball absolved any responsibility for letting Turner play with an inconclusive test out there. And per baseball protocol, inconclusive tests are supposed to be basically treated as a positive test. And Major League Baseball statement did not address that. So just wanted to get your thoughts on the Justin Turner COVID situation. We almost got through a fall classic without the coronavirus rearing its ugly head.
I mean, that was, like, definitely an OMG moment when I heard that. I mean, it's just kind of insane to me that was allowed to happen. And I'm curious too, you know, I'm sure it'll come out in the coming days or weeks or whatever, but, you know, MLB has been using specific testing sites. Mm-hmm. And so obviously these testing sites will have been, you know, conducting samples for, you know, things outside of MLB, but they're no longer getting the crush of 30 teams being tested, you know, every other day and whatnot. Yeah. So I'm just curious as to how it took that long, you know, it's only two teams playing now, you know, to get those results to the point where they didn't get them until the game had already started.
Right.
So I think that's troubling, the process that it even got to that point, that they're getting test results at this point in the season, during games. I know it happened earlier in the year with the Reds and Nick Senzel, which is why he got pulled during a game. But, you know, at this point of the year, you'd think the volume would allow for a little bit of a quicker turnaround. So between that, yeah, the process of him being pulled from the game, but then basically, as the statement said, he just refused to comply with MLB security's orders. I mean, that's kind of ridiculous.
Well, and what kind of security are we talking about here? One of the statements says, when MLB security raised the matter of being on the field with Turner, he emphatically refused to comply. Like, what does that look like? I mean, I'm just trying to picture what the MLB security force looks like here, that they, you know,
I know. Yeah.
It's beyond me. Anyway, Major League Baseball and the Dodgers have some explaining to do, and I'm sure, like you said, some stuff's going to come out over the next few days and weeks here. Now let's shift focus to the Phillies here real quick as we get ready for the offseason. Seven Phillies became free agents here right after the end of the World Series, of course. The two big ones are JT Realmuto and Didi Gregorius. Also, Jake Arrieta, Jose Alvarez, Jay Bruce, Tommy Hunter, Brandon Workman all became free agents. There's a couple guys also that David Phelps could have his option refused and he could become a free agent. And qualifying offers are due by Sunday. So as we look at this, obviously Phil's fans want Real Muto and Gregorius back. Jim Salisbury was reporting that Salisbury would like to stay in Philadelphia and does not seem overly enthusiastic about playing in New York. But of course, as we all know, Real Muto wants to reestablish a new market for catchers here in free agency. So with Real Muto now officially a free agent, where are you on his chances of coming back to Philly, and what do you think it's going to take?
I mean, I still put it at 50-50 because, you know, just like the Bryce Harper situation, John Middleton is the wild card in this. I mean, ultimately, if he wants Real Muto back, he will make it happen. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's the bottom line. So it'll be interesting. I mean, I think for me, the most intriguing subplot is if he signs elsewhere, what Bryce Harper's reaction is going to be. I mean, there was just Instagram, you know, post, I think 2 days ago from Harper's wife of JT and his wife, you know, having a night out with Harper
in Vegas.
And his wife. So I'm just trying to envision, you know, how that would unfold after the fact. But, you know, I think you look at this team and top end talent still matters. Yes, the Phillies must get better at player development and drafting. Like you can't win a World Series or be, you know, a continuous playoff contender if you don't have that young talent to supplement that high end talent. But it's hard to see how they get better in the next year or two if they don't re-sign someone like Real Muto. Mm-hmm. And if you signed Bryce Harper, to me that indication at that time is you are all in these next couple years. Going over the luxury tax, oh well, like you're committed to winning. Mm-hmm. To me, it doesn't make much sense in these next 5 years in particular to not take that approach when you're paying that kind of money for a superstar in his prime. So, I understand that Real Muto wants to set the new catching market standard. So it'll be interesting. I mean, all it takes is one team to blow him away with a massive offer that he can't say no to. So,
yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I will. The one thing I will say for the Phillies, in terms of giving them some credit, is you never want to be bidding against yourself. And so, if they couldn't find, you know, middle ground, you know, before this point, then yeah, you need to see what other teams are willing to pay him. But it's obviously a gamble that they and some bad timing with how spring training got shut down when it did, because you know they still had a couple weeks where things might have been worked out.
Didi Gregorius is also a free agent. Obviously, the Phillies would probably like to have him back, but there are some other options at shortstop, including an internal option in Gene Segura if they really do want to trim payroll and save some money someplace. What do you think the chances are that the Phillies offer him the qualifying offer? And if offered, what do you think the chances are that he would say yes?
I would be very surprised if they gave him a qualifying offer. This year it's worth $18.9 million. I know there's no such thing as a bad, you know, 1 year deal, but it's pretty clear that the Phillies are planning to reduce their payroll. And even with, you know, Arrieta's contract coming off and, you know, Real Muto's a free agent, you don't know if he's returning and you're losing, you know, seven guys at the moment. You know, you still have guys that are going to be making more money. And so, you know, McCutcheon's making $20 million this year, which is a pay raise. Nola's getting a pay raise. You have guys like Hoskins, who's eligible for arbitration for the first time. Eflin will make a pay raise. So when you subtract what's coming off the books and incorporating those pay raises, you're not necessarily saving a whole lot of money. So for me, I would be very surprised if they would do that, because I think Gregorius would accept. Because he seems like the kind of guy, that free agency tier where, you know, above average players seeking multi-year deals are the ones that might be squeezed in this kind of market. So I think it's something where they keep an eye on how his market develops, and you know, if it falls the right way, looking to bring him back. But it's hard to say that he's in need right now when you have Gene Segura and Scott Kingery on the roster who can both play shortstop. So that seems more like a luxury item that I'm not sure the Phillies are going to pursue this offseason.
Last thing, who's running the Phillies right now?
Good question. I mean, I think it's fair to say it's John Middleton. I mean, the hope is, you know, we'll get some answers or an opportunity to talk to McPhail, you know, sometime soon. But I think that's the most important question that nobody really knows the answer to right now. Mm-hmm. And until, you know, they hire someone, perhaps, you know, a president of baseball operations, you know, who would be maybe like a tier under McPhail, but then, you know, once McPhail's contract expires in a year, is, you know, the top guy on the baseball side of things. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, it's not a good position to be in when you have free agency starting in 5 days and you have some kind of critical decisions to make, even down to 40 man spots, who you're keeping and who you're non-tendering in some situations. So mm-hmm. for now, it seems like Middleton is the shot caller right now. And it'll be interesting to hear from McPhail, if that is not the case.
I think we're all hoping that they're able to get something done with somebody in the front office. Maybe, you know, Eric Neander's name has been mentioned, the Tampa Bay Rays GM, as a hopeful possibility to be maybe to take over for Andy McPhail as team president. And Andy moves out now or whatever, but still a lot to be decided, and the Phillies have a lot of decisions this offseason. And Megan mentioned the 40-man roster. She's got a great piece out in The Athletic right now talking about some looking at the 40-man roster and projecting who might stay and who will go. So make sure you check that out. Megan Montemuro's stuff over at The Athletic. You can find it on her Twitter feed at @M_Montemuro. Megan, thanks for coming back on Hittin' Season once again.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, well, one last note before we wrap things up here. The Phillies need a new bullpen coach, everybody. Jim Gott, the team's bullpen coach for the last three seasons, will not return in 2021. This is according to Jim Salisbury of NBC Sports Philadelphia. Jim just has the scoops. He has been the Phillies' bullpen coach for the last three seasons. His contract had expired. Now, of course, this comes on the heels of Brian Price retiring just one season into a three-year contract. And this maybe is a possibility where the Phillies want to just clear the deck so that a new pitching coach could bring his own people in. It's a bullpen. What a bullpen coach does is pretty important. And we know the problems the Phillies had with their bullpen this year. A bullpen coach basically is the manager and pitching coach's eyes in the bullpen. So he monitors relievers' preparation, gives them matchup information kind of on the fly, on the hitters they're going to face when they come in the game. So maybe this is a result of the fact that the Phillies had a historically bad bullpen that seemed like guys who had pitched well in other places performed horribly in Philadelphia this year and really over the last few seasons. So it's interesting to see this come down the pike. And right now, assistant pitching coach Dave Lundquist remains with the club. He's a candidate for the full-time pitching coach position, but now the Phillies have a second position in the pitching staff that they have to fill. All right, folks, it's time for your stat of the week. I mentioned the home runs were a big deal this year. Again, teams going 35-5, in which they out-homered their opponents here in the postseason. 51.3% of all runs this postseason were scored by home runs. That is the third highest rate in a single postseason, behind only 1956 and 1957. However, it's the highest percentage since the postseason expanded to multiple rounds. Remember, in 1956 and 1957, you just had the National League and you had the American League. And the winner of the National League pennant and the American League pennant met in the World Series. The World Series was the only postseason series. So, you know, you get a 6 or 7 game series in 1956 and 57. Those numbers are going to be skewed as opposed to this year, where you had more games, more teams, and more series play in this postseason. And it set a record for the most percentage of runs scored via home runs. Again, I'll remind you, the teams that hit more home runs in these postseason games ended up winning these games the vast majority of the time. So yes, efficiency seems to mean, you know, you win. If you out-homer your opponents, you are most likely winning that baseball game. But it doesn't make watching the games any more fun if you're just kind of standing around waiting for solo home runs all game. And that's kind of what we saw here in the postseason. All right, folks, that's going to do it for this edition of Hittin' Season. My thanks to Megan Montemuro for once again coming on the podcast. And want to remind you all once again to just please leave a 5-star rating and leave a review at the Good Fight podcast feed on Apple Podcasts. And again, tell a friend about this Phillies Major League Baseball podcast. Have them sign up, download, subscribe, do whatever you want to do. You can just download the podcast and you don't want to listen to it, that's fine. Just give us the downloads. That's all we really need, folks. And I know we have a very busy offseason coming, so make sure to check out thegoodfight.com every day for the latest news and information on your favorite baseball team. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. We'll talk to you next time here on Hittin' Season.